Please put your hands together for Steve Kilby.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sorry I wasn't in the room when Andrew made his announcement, but we are recording tonight, just to let you know, and we'll be opening it up for questions at the end. So if you've got a question, we'll ask you to come up the front towards the end of the interview and you can ask Steve your own question. And Steve's very kindly offered to play a few songs for us tonight as well, so that's fantastic.
Don't clap till you hear him.
Steve, I wanted to ask you maybe just start off with an easy one with Robin Hitchcock. You've been doing these shows together.
Yeah.
You've sort of started the tour.
Yeah.
How's it been going?
Like, oh, well, it's great. It's like really two old eccentric English geezers. And then in Melbourne, we were joined by another eccentric geezer, Dave Mason, sort of coming back, and whose voice just sounds as beautiful and as pure and sort of singing in that lovely high register. And Robin himself is an absolute sort of crazy genius and a consummate performer on the guitar and his vocals. We're doing some of my songs, he couldn't learn the lyrics. He's just making them up on the spot every night.
Fantastic.
So he's just sort of going, horse eye on a carpet, I got on the train, I didn't have a ticket. He's just sort of making stuff up. It's really great. He's just sort of got this endless kind of well of stuff coming out of his head.
That's great. And you're actually doing one this Saturday night at the Metro,
This
right?
Saturday night at the Metro. I believe there are still tickets available.
So get down for that. How did you two kind of hook up? Like, where did the idea of the tour kind of come from?
Well, we met up in a loony bin, actually. It was boringly enough, a promoter said, would you like to tour with Robin Hitchcock? And I said yes.
That's it.
There should be some amazing, like, we met up in a Moroccan hash den and, you know, or something like that, but it's not, unfortunately not. No.
And you'd never met before?
Never met before. We'd been, all my life, people have been saying, you should get in contact with Robin Hitchcock. He's you know, he's amazing. He's someone you should work with, but we never actually met up.
Fantastic. So do you think there might be some recordings that come out of it? Or?
Well, he's living in Marrickville for a while, so maybe. I'm trying to talk him into it, but I think he's pretty busy all the time.
On this kind of subject of collaborations, because you've done quite a lot, I think I called you a serial collaborator. You've worked with quite a lot of people. What are you looking for when that sparks that you think, okay, I'd like to work with this person? Like, what is it about?
Yeah, what is that? I don't know. I don't know what that is. Just someone that sort of can be a yin to my yang or a yang to my yin.
Yeah.
You know, I'm adaptable. I can be yin or yang in a relationship. So I'm looking for someone who's sort of got something I haven't got that I can sort of trade off with them.
Sure. And I guess that's the joy, is that moment where someone throws something at you that you wouldn't have thought of yourself and you just...
Yeah. Or you throw something at them that they wouldn't have thought of. Yeah.
Yeah. One of those sort of lasting collaborations has been Martin Kennedy from All India Radio. That collaboration's actually lasted quite a few years. How did that sort of come about, and why with him for so long?
Well, he just sort of comes up with these wonderful backing tracks all the time. Mm. And, you know, it's writing a wonderful backing track takes a lot of time and effort. And he sort of does that for me and just turns up and gives them to me. And you know, then I can go on top of that.
You were a kind of Eno fan early on?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And did Martin's stuff kind of remind you of those ambient...
Oh, yeah. Martin's a big Eno fan, too. We're both a big fans of the low David Bowie low period, which came out a lot in our last record. So, yeah, we have a lot in common in that way, definitely.
Can I take you back to Canberra? I know that's an awful thought.
Yeah, let's go. I want to get away from the people talking, so let's fucking go.
Just because I guess that's where music, even though you're not from there originally, it's probably where you kind of, where you discovered music.
Are you just trying to embarrass me now? Yeah?
Well, I'm from Canberra too, so I know what that's
suburb?
Like.
Which suburb?
Oh, all over the place. Wanningass.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know.
Right.
We don't want to go there.
Nouveau Riche?
No.
No?
But I imagine when you were a teenager in Canberra, that would have just been like, what the fuck am I doing here? Like, what, you know,
it
this
was,
is...
Well, no, I wasn't thinking that because I didn't really know anywhere else. But what happened, it was good for me. If I'd grown up in Sydney, I would have been taking drugs and chasing girls and all that. Well, there was no girls and no drugs that I could get my hands on. So I sort of turned inwards into music. So I like the fact there was no temptation out there. There was nothing to compete with it. So it was just like... I could just focus 100% on music, being obsessed by it all the time.
Yeah, but also there's that, I guess there's that feeling of you're the only one who's into that music when you're in a place like Canberra. It's
very
quite
much.
Isolating.
Oh, yeah.
And I
very
guess you
much.
Would have, yeah, felt that intensely.
Oh, if I met somebody else who liked the same music as me, I was shocked. It was like having a rare blood group or something like that.
Now, 1978 in Canberra, you decide to go back to the UK.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Where'd you get all that from?
You know,
this is like one
Google.
Of those shows. Is someone going to come out and give me a fridge or something?
Absolutely.
At the end of this?
This
or an
is
old
your
school
life.
Teacher come out?
Yeah. But I know that you went back in 1978. That was the first time you'd been back to the UK, which is where you were born.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you because I read that you went back because there were some bands that you loved that you were thinking, these people are never going to play in Australia. I've got to go back to the UK to see them. Otherwise, I'll never see them.
It was a bit like that. I wanted to see The Only Ones. I wanted to see The Doctors of Madness. I wanted to see Dead Fingers Talk. I wanted to see Japan.
Yep.
Who were like still in their kind of glam rock phase. They were fucking incredible. They had an all-girl road crew.
I did not know that. That's fantastic.
And they did this song. They did this song called Obscure Alternatives. I don't know if you know the song. Zero down to zero. And it does this thing. And then it did this thing where the bass stayed the same and the music started to change around it. And I never really heard that. Like in a Canberra band playing, you don't really hear that. And that really started me thinking about this idea of things staying the same and yet the other, and the feeling as the bass kept being playing in the same thing and yet all the chords were changing up and down around that, and the way that felt when it pulled away and lifted away, I sort of, that was enough food for me to go home and, you know, just think about it for sort of weeks, you know.
Yeah,
So yeah, I was taking in the music scene in England. Yeah.
And did you get to see Japan?
I did. Yeah, that's what I was telling you about just then.
No, I mean, you got to see them live.
Fantastic. Of course.
I mean, I was going to bring up Japan because I imagine when you first heard Mick Kahn playing bass, that's like, a kind of revelatory moment, not just because of those kinds of things, but also that fretless bass.
And because he did this.
Yeah.
He was sort of like, he was like a geisha.
Yeah. Amazing.
Sort of whose toes had been stunted, sort of waddling around the stage quickly, playing the most incredible bass line. Like, unfathomable.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he's dead now, but I never even dreamed of being a bass player like guys like that. I never thought I was going to do anything like that, but I was quite stunned by him. And the whole band looked just... They sort of looked like the New York Dolls, but not so fucked up.
Yeah, and beautiful, right?
They were all beautiful.
They were models.
In a virile kind of way, Palmcore, of course. I mean.
But you actually you've dabbled in fretless bass as well, right?
I did dabble in fretless bass, yeah, very badly.
How did you find it? Because it's very hard to do, isn't it?
Well, I didn't do it very well, and I was singing, so what that means, I mean, I don't know for the people who know what the significance is, most guitars have got these frets, so you land anywhere between two frets, and the fret will do the work of making it hit the note, but on a fretless bass guitar, you've got to be right on the fucking money. If you're a little bit that way, like on a violin, you're out of tune.
Yeah.
And of course, I was playing bass and singing, and I just imagine I'm most of the time it must have been I was always something was always a quarter tone out of tune all the time, and it was just purely to be flashy. It wasn't because I was interested in anyone. I thought, wow, this will impress them when I'm playing fucking fretless bass and singing. And instead, it was just I imagine our early gigs were quite dismal.
Even just playing bass and singing is quite a hard thing, I think.
No, it's a bit like. You know when you do that thing?
Yeah, I can't do that.
It's like that. You've got to get separation between the singer and the bass player. They don't interrupt in each other's worlds. So when I'm on stage, there's actually three me's. There's a guy singing, there's a guy playing bass, and then there's another guy standing back there going, wow, I wonder what I'm going to do after the gig. I wonder if the spaghetti bar's still open in Fitzroy Street. You know what I mean? So there's still three people operating, and none of them should ever get in the way of the other one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing thing that's going on in your head.
Yeah, if the singer ever goes, oh, what's the next note? You're fucked.
Yeah.
It's all over because it's like, no, those guys shouldn't be talking to each other.
Pretty much as soon as you got back from the UK, you kind of moved out of Canberra. You came to Sydney.
Yeah, but there were dark clouds on my horizon.
I wanted to ask you why you chose Sydney, because Melbourne to me aesthetically just seems like the place.
You know why? Because I had a girlfriend and when we were in England, she was looking at all the fashion and she said, I could fucking do this easily. So when we got back to Canberra, I learned how to silk screen. She started learning how to sewing things. And of course we went to market day in Canberra. We didn't sell one thing. And then we came up to Paddington Market. And we sold, like, we had an amazing day. And not only that, but people, I was saying, hey, listen, I'm making these cassettes. And people sit in my car and I'd play them a cassette. And they were going, wow, I really like this. Because people in Canberra are going, what the fuck is that? And someone said, I don't know how you can sit in a room and make that music. Though it is. So, but in Sydney, suddenly we were selling clothes and people liked my music and it was just like, hey, we just got to move to Sydney. So we moved to Rozelle so I could soak up some authenticity. We looked at Bondi, believe it or not. Mm. I had 60 grand to spend and we looked at Bondi and we looked at Rozelle and we went, no, Bondi fucking never going to happen. And I bought a house in Rozelle. Because Bondi was like, no way, I'm not living there. Yeah. And the three other guys in the band lived in Bondi in 1980, and I used to feel sorry when I used to go over there and pick them up, believe it or not.
And now you love it, right?
And now it's like...
Yeah. I mean, that first album of Skins and Hearts is pretty much almost you arrive in Sydney and you sign a deal and you're in 301 and recording. That must have just felt like, wow.
Yeah, a sort of rags to riches after 10 years of slogging it out. Because I started when I was 16.
Yeah.
And no, there was some time. There was a bit of time in Sydney with nothing happening. And,
oh, okay.
You know, we got a record deal. Like, we made a really good demo. You know, like, I'd had a four-track for a long time. And I knew by then I'd figured out how to make, you know, the tricks I could use to make myself sound good on a song, because before that, whenever I'd gone in a studio in Canberra, and actually my other band Baby Graham, we had a deal with EMI, and every time we went in the studio I was always having arguments with the engineers and they're going, oh no, you can't do that, oh no, you don't want to do that, oh no, it's too late for that. And so I had to learn how to do it myself, so I had the vocabulary to go, no, I am going to do that, and I'll show you how to do a backwards fucking reverb if you don't know how to do it. You do it like this. Yep. You know what I mean? So I started being able to throw my weight around. But even when we made our first album, I was actually arm wrestling with a guy on the faders who was trying to push things down. I was trying to push him up, and we had our thumbs against each other, looking at each other as we're mixing it. Like, the engineers in those days, in fact, all the roadies and engineers and guys in those days were very anti-musicians. Yeah, like, right. you meet your road crew and stuff now, they're the kind of guys I'd like my daughters to marry. But but the guys back
then... It's changed.
Exactly. But the guys, you know, all the people working in the biz in those days, they were so pig-headed or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, you talked about that four-track recorder before, and I remember reading somewhere that you only had a monophonic synthesizer at the time, which is kind of one note at a time.
Yeah.
But to play chords, you actually played one note at a time, then bounce them down.
Triple tracked it. Yeah.
To play chords.
Triple tracked it. Yeah.
That,
if I was playing a C,
like, that would have just been so time consuming.
Well, you know, that's what you had to do if you had a monophonic. But out of that weakness came a great thing, because the chords, when the notes were played separately, you could put a slightly separate effect. Like, you could amp up the chorus or the flange.
Yeah, right.
So each note within the chord was sort of going against the other ones. So what you've always got to do is never dwell on your weaknesses, but look at what they are and figure out a way to fuck them up and do something positive with them.
Yeah,
that's what I reckon.
Have you thought, God, if I'd started now, how easy it would be? Because, I mean, the sort of access to... you know, computerized kind of recording equipment and all those soft synths and everything that you can get now right at your fingertips and quite accessible and cheap. Does that make you think, fuck?
No, it doesn't actually. It daunts me every time I sit down to record a song and I've got Logic, and you can do anything you want to do. There's nothing you could think of that you could do with a piece of music that you couldn't do. Whatever you could fucking think of, you could do it. And that very notion of being able to do everything often means I do nothing and I just sit there going, oh.
It pulls you back.
It pulls me back.
Into what you are best at.
What the logic? See, I think there. I think it was better for me. It was better to have some restrictions, mm-hmm. knowing when I started, there was only so much I could do. Because I think when you can do anything, yeah, I think it's. I think it's almost. You sort of go right round the other way, and it becomes a negative thing.
Yeah, and a lot of people labour over things endlessly, and the track's never finished.
And it's never finished. Yeah. And you do 5,000 guitar solos because there's 5,000 tracks, and you go, oh, someone will fix that up later. Whereas in my day. You know, you had one track to do your guitar solo. If it wasn't right, you had to keep going until it was right. Mm-hmm. And there was a virtue in that, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that session for that album, Bob Clearmont was the
he mixed it.
Yeah. I mean, he was kind of flown in from the US. That would have been quite a big deal at the time.
Yeah,
right?
It was. I don't know how they got him interested in us because he was doing the Rolling Stones and Roxy Music and Chic and all of that. And suddenly he was out here mixing the Church. He must have been sitting there going, what the? But he was... now, funny, his name's Bob Clearmountain. I imagined he was a Red Indian. But you would think that, wouldn't you? His name was really Roberto Chiamonti. He was a little Italian guy. Yeah, Steve, okay, we can do it like that. And he was really... the only amazing thing about him, when he arrived, he had this roll of carpet, this special carpet, and he rolled the carpet up into a tube to mic up the bass drum. And that was one of the secrets of his sound. So the bass drum would be here, and the roll of carpet would be going right over there, and the mic would be there, and it'd sort of be picking it up like that. I mean, he was always into all these kind of things like that.
Did you use that again?
Did we? No, we didn't, because we didn't know which brand carpet to get.
Was it a surprise for you that they didn't choose Unguarded Moment as the single, the first single from that album?
It wasn't recorded then.
Oh, okay.
No, they recorded. See, everyone thinks Unguarded Moment was our first single, but it was actually a song called She Never Said.
Yeah.
And it actually did. It was my worst nightmare. I always thought my worst nightmare is if we release a single and it comes out and no one reviews it, no one buys it, and it's gone. And that's what happened. And one day I was standing outside a gig and someone had made this ridiculous thing saying, hear the Church play their hit single, She Never Said. And I'm standing there already and this guy walks up to me and said, that's not a hit. There's always someone. Whenever you're down, there's always someone to come along. I remember one night we played a gig in this out in the western suburbs. And there was no one there, and the people there hated us and everything. And at the very end of the night, I was sitting there quietly tinkling on this piano, and a guy came up and said, you've made enough noise for one night, mate.
How dare he?
He fucking dared.
On the subject of Unguarded Moment, I've heard you call that a sort of kind of like an albatross around your neck.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Like, oh, it's just a... I don't know. It's just like not. It's not just the best thing I can do. It's like just. It doesn't have. It's a catchy. You know, it did its job. I don't have that bad relationship with it anymore. But I was dismayed when that became the be all and end all of everything. So, typically, it was all right in Sydney and Melbourne, and it's always all right for the Church in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. But when you go to Wollongong or Wagga Wagga. The whole crowd would be like, you know that machine on at Luna Park where everyone's pinned to the back wall? It was like everyone's pinned to the back wall and there's this huge gulf and you're looking at no one. And then you'd play that song and suddenly they're all up the front going, yeah! And then it'd finish and whoosh, they're all pinned back. So I used to say, I remember one night in Wollongong, I said, this is an ancient Armenian melody and it's used to call in goats and sheep. Sure enough, down, 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 and they all come forward. And with the band's going, bah! But they didn't fucking see the irony at all. So I began to resent the song for all the mojo that it had over me.
Can you listen to that album now?
No, I could not.
Right.
I'd rather listen to fucking Nails on a Blackboard.
What about the rest of you?
What's that?
For a moment, we're
straight. Yeah, but this is the thing I hate about that record. I was singing in this silly voice. I was singing in this kind of... I don't even want to invoke it. But I was singing in a silly voice, and by Blurred Crusade, I'd stopped singing in that silly voice. Well, I mean, your people here going, he's still fucking singing the silly voice. But I stopped singing this artificial. I was trying to be a mixture of John Fox and David Bowie and Mark Bolan and Syd Barrett. And I had this. And like I am a Cockney in some ways, and in other ways I'm a guy who grew up in Canberra. Yeah. So I have a bit of an identity crisis, but on that album I'm sort of like, what kind of fool am I? And it wasn't me at all, and the whole thing had this sort of, I was still in the cocoon, mm-hmm. and then the cocoon broke open, and then sort of on the Blurred Crusade, the church turned into what I see is really the beginning of the church. That other album, it has its moments, but it's not really. And we also got rid of that terrible drummer that we had, who was a sort of a real meat and potatoes, and he was a real bully. He was a bully from my high school. He went to my high school, made my life a misery. I met him 10 years later, and he was with Peter, and Peter says, this could be our drummer. And do I go, no way, this guy fucking bullied me. Or I go, no, we're 25 now, surely he's changed. But he hadn't, and every time I'd say, "Hey, like, can you play something a bit different?" There, he'd be looking at me like, "I could fucking do you. Why should I fucking listen to what you've got to say when I could fucking give it to you?"
Yeah, he was a pretty nasty character. Wasn't
he was, and in the end, he did give it to Marty. He gave it to Marty, it was a real scene. He was kneeing Marty in the guts, and Marty was going up and down and punching him in the face, while Marty's wife at the time was on his back going, "You fucking let him go!" And the manager of the pub wrote on next week's worksheet, "No violence."
Oh, it was just like Packer just recently.
It was worse than that, mate, believe me.
So from Blurred Crusade on, you can listen to your albums? Because I think it must be quite hard for a vocalist to sit down and actually listen to their
I could
work.
Listen to them, but I don't. Why would I?
Oh, that's what I was going
to
ask.
No, like, I don't. I never listen right. to them. The only album I listen to is our latest album. Or sometimes, if I get really... I've got to sort of sneak up on myself to hear things, which is why I've always taken drugs and why I continue to do so. So I can sneak up on myself and go... Oh, fuck. And I can listen to something that I did a long time ago and kind of appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But normally, if I put it on, I'm just... I could put on the Blurred Crusade and go, I'm going to reappraise the Blurred Crusade. And after about 3 seconds in the first song, I'd be going, wow, I wonder if it really will rain today. And then the song... You know, and then I can't concentrate. There's no... it's like my mind isn't interested in hearing it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the other iconic song that a lot of people connect with you is Under the Milky Way...
Yeah.
Sorry to bring it up, but I just want to know, like,
you're... You're not sorry at all. You don't look sorry. You look gleeful.
Well, I just wanted to ask you whether you have the same relationship with that, because obviously...
No, we have more of a... We have a much better relationship, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah, no, I always... It's like always... I didn't... Look, I never thought that was a great song, but I never thought it was a rotten song. And when it became a hit, I was pleasantly surprised. And I thought, well, if I have to be stuck with a song for the rest of my life, I'm glad it's that one and not Unguarded Moment. Or, as I say, shut up at your face.
Yeah.
Because, you know, imagine no matter what you go and do, and you're Joe Dolce, you know, you make a really fucking cool album. And then one day at the end of the gig, you know, and you've played this amazing sort of cinematographic music, and then you have to play Shut Up at Your Face. But sort of like Under the Milky Way is suitable for all occasions. Like tonight, I'm sure, you know, I'll to make people happy, I'll play it. And it's suitable for here and it's suitable for anywhere you go. You can kind of, you can take it anywhere. You don't want it? If you don't want it, I won't play it. Panthalassic Sea. Who are you? Who is this man? Is this someone in a charge here or what?
No idea.
He's got a lot to say.
He does have a lot to say. Maybe he should.
But I like the fact that he's yelling for Panthalassic Sea and he's not yelling out for Under the Milky Way. See, that's the other thing. When you get a big hit and you say, okay, I'm going to play my big hit, half the audience fucking groan. They're going, oh, no. And the other half are going, yeah. So no wonder I'm so mixed up. You see what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah, no,
and I want to please everyone. So what should I do? Play half of it? Or play it backwards? I don't know. So we could have a little show of hands tonight if you want to hear it and if you don't want to hear it.
Okay. We'll have a vote before you before you start playing. Talking about production before, and has it been a kind of like a life's work for you to kind of perfect that? Because every album to me sounds like you've sort of mastered something new. Like the latest album, I think, is quite really, really beautiful and quite dreamy. And but there's a newness to the production that I'm just wondering in your head whether you're constantly trying to push.
No, I don't think you would see our curve going like that. I think you'd see it going like that.
Oh yeah, but
like I think we made some really shockers where we didn't learn anything at all. And after making Priest Equals Aura, which was one of my favourite albums, we went right down the tubes and made some really quite awful, by church standards, quite awful records.
But obviously not on purpose. Like that just happens to artists. So I'm just wondering, in your thinking, where you're always trying to push the sound in the studio.
No, I think I went through a troubled and emotional period where I wasn't trying to push anything except a fucking syringe into my arm, mm-hmm. and I just turned up the studio and I just did. I was just like, oh, whatever, you know. And I was just running on autopilot, yep. and they were okay. I'm talking about records like Sometime Anywhere and Magician Among the Spirits and Hologram of Baal. And then I sort of came back to Australia and I got clean and we did Forget Yourself. And then things started to ramp up again. But then they ramped down a little bit for an album called Uninvited Light of the Clouds. And then our last album we did once again jumped up. And we've got a new album in the can that's coming out sometime this year. And I think we've made, like, as Marcy Tung would say, a great leap forward. Definitely made a great leap forward. It's not a double. No, it's not a double, but it's long. It's going to be very, very long.
Want to talk a little bit about lyrics, because I've heard you say that you really don't labour over them at
no,
all.
No,
it's pretty
no.
much a, if it's not done in half hour, it's not
oh,
worth
I would never spend half an hour.
Not even half an hour?
No.
Wow.
No.
So is it just kind of free, it's free
it's
flowing?
Just, it's just like, yep. it's like I hear a piece of music, and then suddenly this thing starts up in my head and words appear on a reel. And sometimes I can't write them down as fast as they're coming. It just comes. And like some sort of divine intervention. And it 99% of the time it works out. And it's all over in about, I hear the piece of music, I've usually written the lyrics within 3 minutes.
Wow. It's pretty amazing. Because you've got some, you know, amazing lines.
Yeah, so well, they're... I think I'm, look, without being like too mystical about this, I think I'm sort of tapping into some sort of human the untapped human unconscious or subconscious. I think I'm tapping on beyond. They're not coming from me. It's coming from somewhere else. I don't know what that is. Another universe or a muse or something. But I'm sort of, it's coming too quickly, and I don't know. It's like I can never figure out where it came from and what it... It's not like I'm sitting there going, okay, I'm going to write a song about, you know, being in jail and you know, this and then I'll have this. It's all coming too quickly, mm-hmm. from out of nowhere.
And does it always happen, or do you sometimes go, nothing's coming?
Occasionally nothing comes, and then I get really fucking angry. Yeah. I do. And then I have to actually do it on manual. It's like... Then my actual mind has to write them. Yeah. And I can always tell those words. And I know the songs in the church history, my own history, where my mind wrote them and not the other thing. Mm-hmm. And they're always the most awkward and sort of stupid and embarrassing ones.
But you're a voracious reader as well, and you always have been. And you've consumed lots of, you know, you've read lots on esoteric, you know, mysticism and all sorts of stuff. So I'm gathering that feeds into, obviously, the lyrics as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So can you sometimes connect those things like, oh, that's why I wrote that, because I was reading that, or...
Oh, yeah, you definitely get general ideas. You definitely, obviously, you read the Bhagavad Gita or you read the New Testament. Like, if you're a songwriter, you ain't going to walk away from that and go, fuck, now I don't know what to write a song about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember I was doing a songwriting course once, and this kid of 16 said, I don't know what to write a song about. I said, what do you mean? Write about a girl. But I don't have a girlfriend. I said, just write. He said, but then all my friends will laugh at me because they know I don't have a girlfriend.
Aww.
And I was saying, but in a song you can have imaginary girlfriends. You can murder people. You can be a... You can be a millionaire, you can fly, you can be three people at once. You can, in a song, you can be anything or do anything you like. So that's I remember my friend Tom Verlaine said to me once, he said, Kilby, when I started writing songs, I realized you could just write anything. And that's right, you can. And no, almost with any other art form, when people are going to hear something like a piece of journalism or whatever it is, they sort of know what, is this fiction, is this fact? But when you start singing a song and go, I lost my baby, people are going, did he really lose his baby? Or you know what I mean? It's suddenly, because it's a song, all those sort of beliefs and disbeliefs are suspended.
Well, kind of, but there's this flip side to that, which, and you have some really avid fans. So there's this flip side to that of people reading every word on every album and trying to analyse that to try and find out about you. Uh-huh. So they're actually reading your lyrics going, this is Steve Kilby.
Well, they can't because I don't print them.
But they transcribe them. So I'm just wondering, you know,
That's why I don't print them, because I don't want them reading them and thinking of that. I want the lyrics to wash over them. Mm. On our latest album, I've tried to de-emphasize lyrics. I've tried to de-emphasize singing and bringing back into the music, so it's not like a bloke out the front singing this and a bunch of guys at the back. It's like a bloke singing in amongst all the music. I've tried to sort of even more make the lyrics more ambiguous and more kind of mellifluous and less meaningful for someone to try and sit down and go, what does this all mean?
Yeah. I mean, you, at the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned Dave Mason, and I think his classic one is Quasimodo's Dream, which everyone we know agrees. Yeah. Such an amazing. And then he finally admitted, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. It's not about anything. I wasn't, you know.
I think when songwriters say that, It doesn't mean it isn't about anything really. It means it isn't about anything that I can actually say right now what it is. Obviously, it's about something, because when we all hear that song, we're all going, God. Yeah. So it can't be about nothing. But it's nothing that he can put into a nice pithy little thing and go, oh, it's about, you know, when I met my girlfriend or something, you know, and when my car broke down, you know, it contains so many emotions. You actually have to hear the song. It can't be summed up in just a sort of a sentence.
Yeah, I think the best explanation he gave was, because I don't know the story of Quasimodo that well, but you know, he wants to marry the gypsy girl and live in a small house somewhere and live happily ever after. And Dave Mason goes, well, I certainly don't want to be in that dream. You know, that wouldn't have been something he'd wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was it. I want to ask you about album titles, because I think it's one of your amazing abilities is to capture the feeling of an album in an album title. But not only that, I just think when I see your album titles, even before I'd heard the albums, I just went, I want to buy this album. Like,
wow. Yeah, well, that's,
you know,
what
Priest equals Aura. You want to find out what the hell is going on that.
Oh,
album.
Okay. Well,
the Blurred Crusade. Okay. Like, there's so many. It's just
But the truth of Priest equals Aura is this: I was in Spain and there were some schoolgirls getting my autograph. No Rolf Harris sort of stuff. And this girl had this note, had her notebook, and she had written, she'd had an English word and she had equals the Spanish word. And one of the things that said on there was Priest equals Cura. And upside down, I read it, and I thought it said Priest equals Aura. And I immediately said to the rest of the band, our next album's going to be called Priest equals Aura. And they all went, it was sort of like, first time I've never had any argument, they went, yes. It will be.
It's an amazing title. It's just suddenly, and I mean, and the image you have on that album cover, too.
And then did you ever hear that Tism song, Bishop equals Handjob?
Okay, tell us about Gold Afternoon Fix then, because that's another beautiful title.
I hate that record.
The title's good.
The title's just from the title was just sitting there one day, and at the end of the news they said, "And here's the Gold Afternoon Fix," and you know, it's they set the price for gold at the end of the for the Reserve Bank of the whole world, except for Iceland, Syria, and two other countries. That's the Reserve Bank of the whole world. They fix the price of what gold is because they love gold and they want gold. They fucking want so much gold. Yeah, right. And every day they try and figure out what that gold's worth because they really want it.
You've totally ruined that for me now.
It's not about this at all.
No, I hadn't thought that either. Yeah. I actually thought maybe it was a contemplative moment where you were in that, you know, that beautiful glow of the...
No, it was just... It's like, I do this a lot. I just sort of like... My next album's probably going to be called Expect Delays. Or Loading Zone Until 10. I don't know. I sort of... You know what I mean? I just sort of see things and something says... I used to ride the bus all the while from when I lived in Roselle. And I used to ride the bus in the town. I was listening into everybody's conversation, always tuning in for something that could go into the mix.
Yep. You kind of struck me as the sort of person that doesn't need to write any of that down, that you just retain it all.
I think Paul McCartney said the best stuff is let it, when he writes a good song, he used to let it go around his head and he didn't write it down. If he could still remember it the next day, it's worth doing. If you've forgotten it, it wasn't that good, was it?
Yeah, right. What about melodies and the music part of it? Is that the same? Or do you need to quickly, if you think of a melody, do you need to quickly record it?
You know, I usually come up with the melody and the lyrics these days when I'm in the studio and someone says, here's the music. So I usually come up with the lyrics and melody there, so I don't have to remember anything. Okay. I actually make it up and record it sort of on the spot.
You seem really happy and in a good place at the moment. And so I don't want to...
Thanks, Paris.
You do. Shucks. And you look great. You look vital and you look like, you know, you're in a good place in your life. I wanted to ask you about...
What are you doing after the show?
We'll talk about that later. I guess I wanted to ask... There's been some kind of spiritual search for you that kind of connects with the music. Did you come to a place where you just kind of went, I have found some meaning that gives life sort of more enjoyment? Like, was there?
I had one encounter with God in my life. I did. I had. Yeah. Yeah. Not Jehovah though. Forget Jehovah. Don't think of that God. Think of something else. Think of something that's quite inexplicable. I did, and for about 10 minutes until I was in a bad place, and I got down on my knees and said, I'm fucked. I really surrender. I don't know what I'm doing anymore. Is there anything out there? And whatever was out there came in and ameliorated the situation. And as soon as my ego started going, wow, I knew God would dig you, Steve, God was like, see you later. But it was because the only reason the thing could enter my consciousness is because my ego had gone, I'm out of ideas here. And I was just like, fucking what's out there, please. So I do believe in God, but I don't believe in the God of the Old Testament. Mm. I don't believe in a vengeful, vicious Jehovah. I don't believe in all that. But I think there's something wonderful out there that I don't think it's an interventionist God that will make you win the lottery or help you find your car keys. I think it's more of a. I think it's a sort of a something that people, when they drop their fucking mask, could tap into. I was using the metaphor. It's like being a deep sea diver in the sea, and you've got your helmet on. And you take your helmet off, and the water all rushes in. It's the helmet that's keeping the sea out. But you know, a really ignorant person could think they weren't in water at all because they're completely dry. But as soon as I sort of opened up that portal, it rushed in and filled me immediately and kind of and took away all the agony I was in and then whoosh, was out.
Has music been kind of a saviour for you, I guess, in some ways? Like, has it, I mean, you've obviously returned to it over and over again.
Yeah.
But has it felt like your sort of your rock? Like,
Since I got off heroin in about 2000 and started playing, I found... Before that, I was like a guy on stage, you know, playing and thinking it all through. Oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And I've just noticed since I got off the gear and since I had that experience, there's sort of another, the spirit of rock and roll. So I go on stage and I'm feeling like I'm tired and I want to have a wee. And you know what I mean? I'm fucking pissed off and all that. And this is going to be a terrible gig. And suddenly I go and I start playing. And suddenly this tired, old, angry, grumpy, whatever guy, there's this fucking energy I can tap into. I've got this bass guitar around my neck. I can run around for 3 hours and sing and play and get excited. And it's like, where's it coming from? Because it wasn't like that. When I started, that wasn't what I was tapping into. I was tapping into this kind of intellect that was going, you're going to look like this and do that and if put your eyeshadow on and look at that girl over there and all that. Now it's not like that. It's like I start playing and 99% of the time, just like the words coming, this thing comes down and whew, picks me up, and sometimes picks the whole band up. And that's like a quasi-spiritual experience. Absolutely. Like riding a surfboard or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny you mentioned the eyeshadow because I think I was reading...
you said you weren't going to mention the eyeshadow.
No, it was a really cute story that your brother, when he saw you on Countdown for the first time, and he was like, oh my God, I've got to go to school tomorrow. And they're going to go, my brother, is your brother a poofter because he's wearing eyeshadow?
My brother got beaten up the next day.
Oh no.
The Monday after that Countdown Expo, I go, your brother's a poofter, Kilby. That'll teach you.
That should have been such a moment for him. It should have been the glory moment, your brother was on television.
No, he was hiding.
Because that was a pretty amazing time to be on Countdown too. Wasn't
it was.
I mean,
it was everybody watched Countdown. It's true that on the Friday night we played a gig, there were 9 people there. On the Monday night after Countdown, we played a gig in Melbourne at some obscure place. There was 900 people there. And they were like, Michael Chugg was my manager, and he came up. And he gave me a paper bag with $5,000 in it and said, fucking take that away and don't tell anyone. No GST in those days, folks.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was art, because in recent years you've become, you know, a painter and you're actually selling really well. What's that been like in terms of, you know, is it the solace of it that's kind of...
Solace.
Yeah, because you sit. You know, I think painting is kind of a solitary. It's not playing.
It's
in a band,
lot more relaxing. Yeah. I remember once Marty said. He said, "Music is fucking anxiety," and sometimes I can agree with that. Mm-hmm. Like writing a song and all of that, but painting has given me a new context to listen to music in. Because I think I'm such a busy guy, I ain't got time to sit down and listen to a record. But when I'm painting my pictures, I can listen to all those records that I didn't have time to listen to. I find it very, very relaxing. And I like to enter that non-verbal sphere where you forget all your troubles and you're just like working in shapes and colours. And often if one of my kids comes in and goes, Dad, I'm like I could strangle them because they've like... It's like they've wrenched me out of another cosmos when you're sort of really getting into it. It's far more relaxing. If I could go back and do it all again, if I could be a successful painter and not a musician, I might choose that.
There's still time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. By the time I'm 90, I could be really good.
Let's talk about the new album, just because I know a lot of people are really sort of champing at the bit to hear it. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about it?
Well, unfortunately, the bad news is, I guess you all know this, Marty Wilson Piper is no longer a member of the church.
Mm-hmm. Come back in, though.
I very, very much doubt that. I think there's more chance you'll come in than he will.
Oh, really? Is it that bad?
It's just like he's had enough, and we had enough, and without any big hoo-ha, it just ended. He's not available. It's over. So, you know, I was sitting around one day and with Tim Poles, the drummer, and we're going, we've got to get a new guy in. Marty doesn't want to make our new album. I had got finance to make a new album. I was writing to Marty, I've got the money to make a new album. Let's make a new album because we haven't made an album for 5 years. And no response. So Tim and I knew we had to get someone in, but we couldn't get some little... It had to be someone with a bit of oomph, with a bit of mojo. And my girlfriend said, why don't you ring Ian Hoag? He's a mate of yours and Powderfinger's broken up. So I rang up Hoagie and said, would you join the church? And he went, yes. And then I was very worried because what if it didn't work out? And then I went up to Hoagie's and we sat down within a minute. We had written one of the best songs on the album called Miami. The moment he and I sat down, we started writing this song, and then Peter turned up and Hoagie joined the band. And he's not Marty. He's not, in many ways, he is not Marty. He's not trying to be Marty. But he's Ian Hoag, and he was in fucking Powderfinger. And I know a lot of people, Powderfinger. Powderfinger were a fucking good band, especially when you consider how huge they were. Like they were the biggest band Australia ever had, and yet they were not a load of old rubbish. And I really like Powderfinger, and I saw them a few times, and they were huge fans of the church. They used to hang around us when they were 16. Wow. And we'd come out and they go, ah, what's that?
Not as good as the church.
Well, different, right? Different. So
not as good.
No, okay, but but seeing we couldn't have Marty, we needed someone with a bit of oomph. We needed someone who had his own style and like a big guy on stage and could, you know, play some guitar. Hoagie joined the band and a lot of tension was gone and it allowed us to really focus in on looking at every parameter in the music. Not when we're writing songs, not taking anything for granted, like anything, oh yeah, just everything's going to be like that. We really went over every last thing, looking for ways we could change it and improve it. And there's been so much love and time and energy's gone into this album. I just really hope everybody's is going to dig it and can get over the fact. I understand how traumatic it is for a church fan that Marty's gone. It's like when Richard Lloyd left television. It's kind of it's like that. But it's also he it was going to be this or nothing. It was with Hoagie or no album at all. And we've made this new album. I'm really happy with it. So I when it comes out, I do hope people like it.
Woo-hoo! Yeah. Woo! 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 So you've said this year, so it'll definitely be this year?
It's being mixed right now. Oh, I've been bombarded all day with people sending me mixes. What do you think of this? What do you think of this? What do you think of this? And because I'm so fucking deaf, I don't know what I'm listening to anymore. I'm going, I don't know. I have to listen to things like this to hear them. So someone should invent this little thing that goes across the back of my head and has two cups.
That'll be a good look.
It'd be great, won't it? With the mascara.
Yeah. I'm going to open it up to questions in a minute. So if you've got a question, maybe make your way up the front here to Andrew, who's got the microphone, just so we don't lose any time. But Steve, maybe one last question. You're kind of one of those musicians for me, because of your history, all your collaborations, all that stuff. You're kind of one of those joys to discover if someone isn't familiar with you. Because they hear something and then they go, my God, this guy's got lots of
loads
stuff to discover.
Stuff.
Bootlegs and, you know, crazy different issues and stuff.
Let me just say this. Mm. I have written more published songs than any other songwriter in Australia. Yes. Like, let's say this. And I know, okay, of course, quantity isn't quality. I know that.
But it is.
No, it isn't. But just to put it in perspective, Robin Hitchcock, who's a year older than me and has done a lot of albums, he's got 450 songs published. I've got 800.
Wow.
So... So I have written a lot of fucking songs. Maybe most of them aren't good, but I have written a lot.
I think everyone would disagree with that. I wanted to ask you, though, where would you point someone that hasn't heard a lot of church music?
It's rude to point, you know that.
Where would you say, start here? This is where...
Someone who said, I want to hear one thing you've done?
Well, no, just I want somewhere to start. I want an entry point.
Fuck, I wouldn't know. I reckon on any day it would be something different.
Oh, okay. Do you have a favourite album?
Jack Frost.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure, Jack Frost, yeah.
All right. Do we have some questions? Oh, come on.
I wish someone would ask me a question like, how many metres in a furlong? Or something like that.
Steve, how many metres in a furlong?
I don't know.
Oh, good question then. On the subject of spirituality, you let go of your ego and... then you felt something bigger come in. Did you follow that up? Have you followed a spiritual path since then?
Yeah, but I could never get rid of my ego so much again. The situation was I had a massive heroin habit. I went into rehab in America. I had drugs for 3 days to get me through the worst, and then suddenly I was on my own. And I was so fucking sick. In every way, there was no refuge. I couldn't sleep. I was vomiting. I had diarrhea. I was sweating. Every bone and muscle in my body, I felt thoroughly miserable. I didn't even know who I was. And my ego finally said, I ain't driving this bus anymore. I'm out of here. So for me to invite God in, that guy couldn't be there. Because as soon as that guy's there in one tiny way going, hey, look, he's coming. He's digging you, Steve. I knew Jesus would dig you. You know, as soon as you have that voice at all, the thing can't get in. But so it was only in this most extreme circumstance when I'm kind of going, help, which I've never been able to manifest again. Every other time I'm going, I've never been in such a dire, I'm sure if I'm ever in such a dire situation again that the ego goes away, it can happen. But that's my experience, that you can't find God when ego's there going, wow, you're a cool guy getting God to come into your heart. You know, it just doesn't work like that. For me, anyway.
Do we have any other questions?
Yep. How many meters in a furlong?
I don't know. I want to ask you about an old church record that I really like, and I'm sure, I think I've read somewhere that you're a little bit dismissive of it. That's Sing Songs.
Uh-huh.
I want to ask you what you think about that one.
That's a really interesting record.
I really like that record.
Yeah, no, and that's at the time I really thought some of the tracks were great. I thought there was a track on there called The Night Is Very Soft, and I thought I thought for the first time the church had done something sexy. Because we hadn't been sexy up until then. We'd been kind of romantic and brooding and blah. And then suddenly on this song, we had this kind of beat. And I thought the lyrics were kind of... It really had this... I sing myself this smouldering, sexual sort of thing. So I really liked it for a while. I liked that song. I liked another song called In This Room. But the rest of it was all just a bit of a hodgepodge, I thought. And it was kind of... It was the beginning of... We had an early peak with Blurred Crusade, and that record was the kind of beginning of our falling out with the Australian public until Heyday came along. We sort of plummeted down with that record. It was sort of disappointed people. But I have fond memories of a couple of those songs, definitely. And I'm glad to hear people talking about that, definitely. Different Man's Church by Numbers. That's when I hate when I write a song that's like... I mean, obviously I could sit down right now and write Church by Numbers forever, but who wants to hear it? And that's what Different Man is. And when I wrote Different Man, I thought, I don't want to do any more songs like that. That's the end of the line of those kind of numbers, you know? It's just like a following this little formula. And it's like, I left that for somebody else to do, so... I wanted to sort of do something else. And then with Heyday, suddenly with the whole band writing the songs, wow, we discovered this whole new thing and everything just ramped up. And the public reacted. People who are going, oh, I'm sort of tired of the church. They sort of had it. They're over. And for about 4 years, we wallowed in this feeling of being, you know, has-beens. In 1983, we were already has-beens. Oh, it's all over for those guys. And we're getting kicked off record labels. And no one wanted to know about us. And then we made Heyday and, wow, it really changed things around again and people were kind of back interested in us again.
I'd like to ask you, is there another Bastard Universe coming along somewhere?
You know, the church have got so much music on tape. We have so many...
We love jams as well.
Yeah, well, there's so many jams, there's so many bits of music. It's just a matter of... someone getting them out there and sorting through it all. There's just so much stuff that we've recorded.
Because Russell on
the job.
Who? Russell.
My brother?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, he wants to sit down and sort through my fucking old music. You're joking, aren't you?
He has done a few times.
No, he hasn't.
With your song?
No, he's a filmmaker now. He's made a movie called The Man from Cox's River.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, my brother's not interested in sorting out my jams. No, he's definitely not interested in sorting out my jams. Maybe my mum could sort through my jams. She does a very nice tart.
Steve, you've been very generous, and just want to ask everyone to put your hands together and thank Steve Kilby.
Thank you very much.